are the latest breakthroughs concerning Alzheimer's disease? And how close are we to a cure or improved treatments? We'll discuss the latest research on Alzheimer's disease and the concern over a lack of research dollars to study it more thoroughly. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Wednesday, November 6th. November is Alzheimer's Awareness Month, and our guest is an Alzheimer's researcher and will be part of an informational event on Alzheimer's that is taking place later this month in Madison. We'll tell you more about that a little bit later. But we also want to know about your questions about Alzheimer's disease and whether this disease has touched your family. And whether you think enough is being done to research its causes and cures. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Dr. Cindy Carlson, an assistant professor of geriatrics in the Department of Medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Dr. Carlson's research focuses on vascular risk factors for Alzheimer's disease and how to treat them. Good morning. Well, I don't hear our guest because I don't have the right buttons pushed.
No.
Now I hear you. Good morning.
Hello. Good morning.
Sorry about that.
That's all right.
Let's just start with Alzheimer's 101 here. What exactly is Alzheimer's disease?
Alzheimer's disease is a disease that usually affects people later in life, usually in their 60s, 70s. It's very related to age. So again, it's not a normal part of aging, but it's a disease that eventually leads people to develop memory problems, maybe some problems with word finding, and some behavioral changes sometimes, and eventually leads to functional impairment and then eventually to early death. So it's a disease that, again, we see more commonly in older adults, but we try to remind people that it's not a normal part of aging, and that's why we're trying to work to try to help people live longer, healthier lives without struggling with memory problems.
What's the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's?
That's a great question. A lot of people get them confused. Basically, Alzheimer's disease is the most common form of dementia. So technically, dementia is a medical condition that causes an impairment in different thinking abilities. So, for example, memory, language, and other things, how well you multitask and kind of process information. And then that impairs their function. So not just, you know, a lot of us will go into a room to get something and forget what we went into the room for, or may misplace our keys or things like that. But those are things that don't affect our day-to-day function. When someone has dementia, their memory impairment and their thinking abilities are so affected that they might not be able to remember, for example, how to get to their daughter's house where they've lived for 10 years, or may not remember how to do some of their volunteer activities at the retail shop where they work. So it really is memory problems that are strong enough to affect their day-to-day function. And then for some, there's different types of dementia, and the most common type of dementia is Alzheimer's, which is a kind of gradually progressive disease. Again, usually affecting people later in life, but not caused by other things like medical problems or strokes or other kind of conditions like that.
How is it diagnosed, or is it diagnosed?
Alzheimer's disease is diagnosed in a clinic. So again, there's no test to diagnose Alzheimer's. There's not a single blood test or brain scan that can diagnose the disease. It really takes a lot of discussions with patients and their families, because the key diagnostic criteria are all very clinical, meaning that we have to kind of understand where the person was previously with their thinking abilities. You know, we all start out with different strengths and weaknesses, and we don't want to label someone with a dementia who maybe had a car accident early on, or maybe someone who struggled with math early on. We want to be able to understand who that person was at baseline and then see how things have changed over time. So it takes a lot of talking with the patient and the family. And then we do some blood tests to make sure that they don't have other things that could contribute to memory problems, such as vitamin deficiencies or thyroid problems. So we screen for those as well. And then usually we'll do some type of brain scan just to make sure they don't have a stroke or something unusual that's contributing to memory problems. Mm-hmm. But it's a very clinical diagnosis, meaning a lot of it is just talking with someone. We usually will do some thinking tests, some cognitive tests to screen for different thinking abilities. But again, mainly our diagnosis is made by waiting until someone gets memory problems and then talking with them in clinic and diagnosing it that way.
Way back when, I remember hearing that you never confirmed Alzheimer's anyway unless an autopsy was done and the brain could actually be viewed.
Right, that's correct. To have a definite diagnosis of Alzheimer's, you do need to be able to look at the brain tissue because sometimes there can be conditions that mimic Alzheimer's pretty closely and can look exactly like Alzheimer's in a person. But then when you look at the brain tissue, what's causing the disease is actually different than was thought previously.
So do we know how significant a problem this is, how widespread Alzheimer's is?
Alzheimer's disease is increasing rapidly, and part of it is because our population's aging, so that demonstrates the success of other treatments of other illnesses. But again, more people are living into their 80s, and by the time we get into our mid-80s, about half of us will have Alzheimer's disease at the rate things are going now. So right now it's estimated that over 5 million people in the United States and over 110,000 people just in Wisconsin alone have Alzheimer's disease, and this number is expected to triple over the next 40 years or so. So it's a pretty significant problem, and part of the difficulty with Alzheimer's is that, it really affects the core of who we are as people, our thinking abilities, our abilities to relate to others, and it also has a great burden on caregivers and family members and our healthcare system, in addition to the devastation of the disease on the person themselves.
Do we know what causes Alzheimer's?
There are some theories, and this is really where there have been a lot of breakthroughs, is trying to better understand the underlying cause of Alzheimer's. So frequently what people will read about in the papers or the newspapers will be about plaques and tangles. So what those are, plaques are made up of this protein called amyloid, which is kind of a sticky protein that deposits in the brain and interferes with how well the neurons, the nerve cells in the brain, can communicate with each other. And then there's another protein called tau, which is inside these tangles, and these tangles are inside the nerve cells of the brain. And together, these two kind of proteins build up and contribute to the memory loss related to Alzheimer's. Kind of where it affects the brain is the reason that we get different presentations, why some people have more problems with language, or some people have problems with vision, or problems with memory, depending on where in the brain it affects the person.
Mm-hmm. But do we know if there's an environmental cause, or is it a genetic cause?
While we mainly think about Alzheimer's in people who are in their 70s, 80s, there are some forms of Alzheimer's that are seen very early and run very strongly in families. So there are some people who are in their 40s who get Alzheimer's disease and may have 50% of their family affected. Thankfully, those types of Alzheimer's disease, that type is rare, but again, that's very, very strongly linked to three specific genes. And so if a person inherits that gene, they're likely to get Alzheimer's disease. They will get Alzheimer's disease. Whereas the type that accounts for about 95% of Alzheimer's disease, the late onset Alzheimer's disease, does have some genetic component, but we're only just beginning to understand what genes contribute to this late form. And we realize there's a lot of other factors that contribute. So things like vascular risk factors, our diet, our lifestyle, how much we exercise, how engaged we are in the community. So a lot of those other factors contribute to late onset Alzheimer's, again, which is the most common type.
We'll talk more about those, the risk factors and reducing your risk for Alzheimer's, as we are talking with Dr. Cindy Carlson, an associate professor of geriatrics in the Department of Medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She will be speaking at an event on November the 21st at the Monona Terrace in Madison, It starts at 5 o'clock and will go until 8:30 p.m. It's called Aging Strong, Reducing Your Risk for Alzheimer's. And we'll post some more information about that event on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. But right now, we invite your questions about Alzheimer's disease, about risk factors, about prevention, about treatment, and about research. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. November is Alzheimer's Awareness Month, and we are talking with a guest expert on Alzheimer's disease and welcoming your questions. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 20 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Wednesday, November 6th. Our guest is Dr. Cindy Carlson, an associate professor of geriatrics in the Department of Medicine at UW-Madison. Dr. Carlson's research focuses on the vascular risk factors for Alzheimer's disease and how to treat them. Well, let's talk a little bit about that, Dr. Carlson. What are the vascular risk factors for Alzheimer's disease?
Well, we have known for a long time that vascular risk factors, so things like high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, that these factors all increase our risk for heart disease and stroke. But the data is showing now that these also increase our risk for developing Alzheimer's disease down the road. What we don't know yet is if we treat these vascular risk factors more aggressively, you know, putting more people on cholesterol medicines, treating blood pressure when it's borderline, really trying to control these vascular risk factors better, we're not sure yet if doing that will help prevent Alzheimer's disease or at least delay it in some people. And that's what my research focuses on, is trying to better understand in particular, how treating cholesterol will potentially help reduce risk of Alzheimer's disease.
Interesting. So there is a definite link established between, say, high cholesterol and Alzheimer's.
Yes, they think that cholesterol not only affects the blood vessels to the brain, but also can affect how much of that amyloid's deposit into the brain that forms those sticky deposits, those plaques in the brain. So there's a lot of evidence that cholesterol plays a role in it, but we're not sure exactly if treating the cholesterol will help protect against Alzheimer's yet. So that's what we have some clinical studies looking at that right now to better understand that.
Well, my research into this topic tells me that you're concerned that a lack of research money is hampering the research into Alzheimer's disease.
It is. Again, there's been a struggle with research funding in the recent years. I think it's across the board for all types of research, but particularly in Alzheimer's disease, we haven't had any big breakthroughs yet. We've had a lot of good research that's shown us more about what are the early changes in the brain that lead to Alzheimer's, because our goal is to really target these changes early so we can try to prevent the disease or at least slow it down early on. But the research funding, again, hasn't really kept up with our need to better study this disease in people. And that's part of the problem, is that Alzheimer's disease is such a uniquely human disease. Again, there's certain animal models and cell models that can teach us a little bit about the disease, but you know, personality changes and memory is really a unique human experience. And so a lot of these studies need to be done in people, which are, again, it tends to be more expensive, and so having less research funding means that it's going to be slower progress in this devastating illness.
Well, we'll talk more about that, but we do have some calls. Lana in Oconto is with us. Hi, Lana.
Hi.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello.
Go ahead, Lana.
I have a question. We know something was going on with my mother, because she kept packing her drawers and she kept cleaning out her drawers. Well, besides that, she went into surgery for gallbladder, and she was my mom when she went in. I mean, she knew who we were and everyone else. And when she went into surgery, she come out of surgery not knowing anything. It was full-blown, And she was 83 when she went into surgery. She had two surgeries back to back. On the first one, she came out just, you didn't know who she was. She didn't know who you were. What does the effect of the anesthetic, does that bring it out more, or is it dangerous to go into something like that? And
Lynn, I'm so sorry for what you experienced. It almost sounds, Dr. Carlson, like a stroke might have happened during surgery. That happens sometimes.
It does sometimes. So we know that when people have, if you already have dementia and you head into a hospital stay for even like a pneumonia, people can get what's called a delirium, where they get more confused and their memory problems become more pronounced. And it sounds like, you know, she could have had a little bit of that. Plus, you know, for someone to have an abrupt change like that, I agree, it sounds like she may have had a stroke or somehow low blood flow to the brain that made her symptoms worse. There are some studies that say that some anesthetics can contribute too, but usually it's not a quick change like that. So it sounds more like she may have had a stroke or, you know, and probably some delirium on top of that.
Lana, thank you very much for the call, and I'm sorry for what you went through there. We have Jenny on Facebook who says, my mother really thrived using Aricept. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. She was the third sibling, and her mother also had Alzheimer's. I hope I won't. Well, that's first off, what's Aricept?
Aricept is one of three medications in a certain group called cholinesterase inhibitors. And basically, those are medications used to slow down the symptoms of Alzheimer's. There's one more. The other two are galantamine and then rivastigmine. So those three kind of all work the same. And there's one other medication we use to treat Alzheimer's called Namenda or memantine. And that one, again, just helps slow down the symptoms. But none of these really change underlying disease that's occurring.
She also was very concerned that her mother was one of three siblings who had Alzheimer's. Her grandmother had Alzheimer's, and now Janie's worried. Should she be worried?
This is an area that actually here in Wisconsin at our Alzheimer's Disease Research Center that we focus in on. Our center focuses in on adult children of people who've had Alzheimer's disease, in particular the late onset form, which again is the most common. Because there is something to having a parent with Alzheimer's and a family history that does increase our risk. And we're not sure if it's genes that we inherit or is it shared lifestyle patterns. So we eat similar foods and have similar exercise patterns. There's a lot of those things kind of grouped together in families that does increase risk. So this is where we really encourage people to be a part of our center and to help us answer these questions. We have over 400, close to 500 people now who have volunteered to be a part of our center and help us to better understand these risk factors and how, you know, how we can really reduce their risk. That's really the focus of our center, is on trying to find ways to prevent Alzheimer's.
And what is the name of the center?
It's the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. It's funded by the National Institutes of Health, one of only 20-something programs in the country. So we're really thankful to have the support of the NIH to help with this center. And basically what it does is it links us to these other 20-something centers in the country so that we can work together to find answers faster.
Well, we'll put a link to that website also on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I know we have a link there already for the, I believe it's the Alzheimer's Association. We have Teresa, who emails, my uncle was recently diagnosed with dementia. The doctor said it was linked to PTSD. The family didn't realize how bad it was until he spent 2 weeks at our house fixing our deck and didn't remember doing it. It's heartbreaking because he knows what is going on and gets really embarrassed when he is caught forgetting things, like when he got up, showered, and changed into his Sunday clothes on a Tuesday. So that would be signs or symptoms of a problem.
All right. And again, PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder has obviously been a huge problem for our veterans coming back from their time in the service. and for other people who've gone through traumatic life events, in trying to better understand how that increases a person's risk for Alzheimer's is still under investigation. But again, we know that brain trauma affects risk for Alzheimer's. And again, depression is linked to Alzheimer's. It doesn't necessarily cause it, but might be a kind of early symptom of memory change. So again, the post-traumatic stress disorder is something that's being actively investigated to better understand how is it linked to Alzheimer's.
Well, we will pause now for news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we'll continue taking more of your questions, your experiences with Alzheimer's disease. Do you know someone with Alzheimer's disease? What questions do you have about the latest research into the causes and treatments? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We'll also talk more on things we might be able to do to prevent Alzheimer's disease. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are raising our awareness of Alzheimer's disease during this November Alzheimer's Disease Awareness Month. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 6:37 on this Wednesday, November 6th. We're talking about new discoveries on diet, exercise, and risk factors that may be linked to Alzheimer's disease. Talking with our guest about how research is being hampered by a lack of money. And we're welcoming your questions and concerns about Alzheimer's disease. Maybe your experiences. Do you have a loved one who has Alzheimer's disease? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest is Dr. Cindy Carlson, an associate professor of geriatrics in the Department of Medicine at UW-Madison. Dr. Carlson's research focuses on vascular risk factors for Alzheimer's disease and how to treat them. And she will be part of a special event on Alzheimer's disease on November the 21st at the Monona Terrace in Madison, Aging Strong, Reducing Your Risk for Alzheimer's. And before we go back to the phones, we have many calls. Dr. Carlson, what can we all do to reduce our risk for Alzheimer's?
Well, again, there's no proven therapies right now for how to prevent the disease. But in general, what we think helps are things that are just common sense for other diseases. So, for example, keeping your blood pressure under good control, keeping your weight at a good level, exercising regularly, staying socially and mentally active. So those things are, again, probably good for us all around, but we think that there's actually some evidence they reduce risk of Alzheimer's. What I encourage people to do, though, is to get involved in our research studies, too. Again, we have a lot of studies to try to help us find out what are the best ways to prevent the disease, and that's really what our Alzheimer's Center is focusing on.
Mm-hmm. Well, according to the Alzheimer's Association, deaths from Alzheimer's rose 68% in the decade from 2000 to 2010, while deaths from other conditions such as stroke, heart disease, and HIV have fallen. Why are we seeing fewer deaths for stroke and heart disease, for example, and more deaths for Alzheimer's?
Well, it's a complicated question because part of the reason that people are living long enough to get Alzheimer's is because they're being treated well for their heart disease risk factors. Mm-hmm. So, again, there's a lot of progress in those diseases. Alzheimer's disease is very tied to our age, and so the older we are, the more risk we have for developing Alzheimer's. So that's part of it, is that we're living longer. But there may be some other changes in our diet and lifestyle and other factors that might be contributing. So, again, that's part of what our Alzheimer's Center is trying to study, is to better understand what are the most important risk factors so we can target those and try to prevent the disease or at least slow it down so we can live longer, healthier lives without memory problems.
Let's go to Dee and Amory next. Hello, Dee.
Hi. I have a question for the doctor about if Alzheimer's doesn't progress differently for every patient, because I know several people who had early onset the diagnosis, not early as far as age, but the beginning stages. And it never progressed any further. I mean, isn't it pretty much an individual situation?
That's a great question. Most people progress at a different rate, so frequently what we'll do is see them in clinic, try to get an understanding of where their thinking abilities are, and then follow them over time. Sometimes if people get the disease earlier, they might progress more rapidly. If they get it later in life, usually it progresses more slowly. But there are a lot of factors that influence how quickly it progresses, and those are things that we're trying to better understand through research. One thing is, too, though, in our memory clinics, frequently we'll go through and make sure there's not other things that are imitating Alzheimer's. So, for example, very poorly controlled sleep apnea or medication side effects that might be affecting someone's brain. So we really try to do a careful job of making sure there's not other treatable things that could be affecting memory. And frequently those patients are the ones who will stay stable over time and not progress. Sometimes we'll also think again and say, is this really Alzheimer's or is it something else? So I think, you know, getting a good evaluation by someone who's a specialist in memory care is really important. If there's something unusual about how someone's presenting, maybe they don't have the disease after all. So,
well, what is the I guess the guideline? Let's say I'm a woman in my 50s and I'm starting to have more memory issues than I ever had before. Not that I'm talking about myself, Dr. Carlson, but should I go and have my doctor screen me for, you know, Alzheimer's?
If someone has memory symptoms, then we do recommend they bring it up with their primary care physician. There's some screening tests we can do. Sometimes a primary care provider might be able to say, oh, this might be a side effect of your medicine. Let's take you off of this one medicine. Or in some young people, sometimes depression can affect memory as well, and in older adults also. So the primary care provider might be able to treat someone for depression or make some medicine changes to help their memory. But in some cases where the memory symptom isn't straightforward or it looks like it might be related to something that could get worse over time, then getting in very early to a memory clinic is a very good idea. We have a lot of great memory clinics here in Madison and actually throughout the state. As part of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute, they have memory clinics that are linked to our university throughout the state of Wisconsin so that people can go within their community to someone memory evaluation. So we really encourage people to get seen early so we can do something about what's causing their memory problems.
Tom in Burlington is with us now. Hi, Tom.
I come from this from a different angle. I write music and I work with some of the best people in the country. I talked to, as a matter of fact, yesterday, Patricia Birch. She was a choreographer for Grease, and she did Grease. She was a director for Grease too, and I worked with Billy Byers. He was the arranger for A Chorus Line, and I worked with Warren Casey. He wrote Grease, and we wrote a musical called America Americana in 1890s. And when we did our research for the costumes, we looked at these women, and they couldn't breathe. They had this hourglass look, which is they tie themselves up, they tie their stomachs up, and try to look. Well, it's not natural. So what happens is when people breathe, the diaphragm in your stomach is supposed to go down, and that pulls the air into your lungs. And if you tie that up, you're not getting 10%, 20%, 30% of the air, oxygen you're supposed to get with your lungs with every breath you take.
Thank you very much, Tom. Tom Weiss has some interesting stories about Hollywood and stuff. Leads a fascinating life. But what about, is there a link between, he wants to make the point that there's a link between oxygen intake and Alzheimer's, perhaps,
right?
Shallow breathing, not enough oxygen.
Right, and that's a great point to bring up, because we are finding more and more that conditions that lower oxygen at night, for example, like sleeping problems, like obstructive sleep apnea, are related to risk of cognitive impairment. So getting good oxygen to the brain is critical. And so again, if someone has sleep apnea, where they're waking up in the middle of the night and kind of snorting to wake themselves up, or they're feeling sleepy all the time during the day, they may want to also be evaluated by their primary care clinician and also possibly a specialist, because that low oxygen at night could also be affecting not only their heart health, but also their brain health and risk for Alzheimer's.
Our guest is Dr. Cindy Carlson, an associate professor of geriatrics in the Department of Medicine at UW-Madison. And we are talking about Alzheimer's disease, talking about risk factors and prevention, and welcoming your questions. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about Alzheimer's disease during this November Alzheimer's Disease Awareness Month. And we are talking with an Alzheimer's researcher from UW-Madison, Dr. Cindy Carlson, who is also a part of an Alzheimer's awareness event that's taking place in Madison at the Monona Terrace on November the 21st. And Dr. Carlson, what do you hope to accomplish with this event?
This is an event that our Alzheimer's Disease Center puts on every year, and basically it's an outreach event to the community so we can help kind of serve as a liaison between what's happening in the research world and what's happening in the real world in people's lives. We really want to be able to not only teach them about the research that's going on and about new advances in therapies for Alzheimer's, but many of us are clinicians as well, and we want to be able to help people with their questions, just like we are today, talking about questions with Alzheimer's disease, help people to get plugged into the resources in the community. We have a lot of great resources to help people who are going through this disease. And we also want to help people to live healthier lives. So through the talks, we'll be talking about exercise and diet and what are some other things people can do to help protect their memory. So Dr. Asfana, who leads our program, and Dr. Antono, and Dr. Benlin and Dr. Cook will be giving some talks, and then a lot of us will be there on the sidelines just to answer people's questions. So we really encourage people from the community to come because it's our way to kind of interact with people and outside of clinics and to really help them better understand the disease and make sure people are treated appropriately for this disease.
So would it be safe to say that if we would follow the guidelines for exercise and diet for a healthy heart, that would also be good in terms of prevention of Alzheimer's disease?
We think that it probably will be. Mainly, I recommend for my patients that they aggressively follow the guidelines because it's good for their heart. We know that for sure that it's good for their heart and for their risk of stroke. And so following those guidelines will be good for them either way, but hopefully we'll have more research that shows that it helps at least delay onset of Alzheimer's disease, if not prevent it in some people.
We have an email from Beth in Wanakee who wants to know, is there a relationship between Alzheimer's and diabetes, type 1.5, also known as type 3?
There is a link between diabetes and Alzheimer's disease. There's a stronger link between diabetes and vascular dementia, which is the type that's caused by stroke. But we do have evidence that diabetes increases risk for Alzheimer's. Actually, one of our speakers at our November event on the 21st is Dr. Barbara Bendlin, who does research looking at how diabetes and a condition called metabolic syndrome, which is kind of a pre-diabetes condition, how those increase risk for Alzheimer's disease. And so she'll be talking about that at the event as well. But again, this is just another example of how important it is to keep those risk factors under good control and having good diabetes control.
Our next caller is Misty in Cable. Hello, Misty.
Hi. I just wanted to call and thank your guest for promoting the awareness and risk reductions in the dementias in Wisconsin. I would also like to share with your listeners that they can assist and support risk-reducing factors in their community and with their loved ones through early intervention programs in their communities. I myself am facilitating one that's called LEAPS. It's an exercise and socialization program here in northern Wisconsin. So encouraging people to call their local agency, their local ADRCs, to get more information on how they can help their family members and community members, I think is something that I wanted to share.
I'm glad you did, Misty. But also, just give us a quick lesson on LEAP.
Oh, LEAPS. yes. LEAPS is an acronym, and it stands for Language Enriched Exercise Plus Socialization. And it's an early intervention program that matches volunteers in the communities and people with early memory loss to increase their exercise by reducing some of the risk factors that you had discussed earlier in the program, and introducing language activities to help stimulate the brain, and having that volunteer take the participant into the community and socialize them, and helping them maintain that community awareness and connection.
That sounds good, doesn't it, Dr. Carlson?
That's great. And I think a lot of these programs in the communities are ways that people can really make a difference for Alzheimer's disease, getting involved in these programs, in these local outreach programs, different events, ways to help enrich an environment for people with Alzheimer's and people at risk for Alzheimer's. And I think the other thing, too, again, is getting involved with research. There's a lot of good community programs around. There's a lot of good research programs around. And that's ways that people can work together as families to really make a difference in trying to prevent this disease. So, again, I applaud you for your work in the community, and thank you for sharing that.
Thanks, Misty. Jackie in Drummond is with us. And, Jackie, I think you called in during our open line yesterday and wanted a program on this, didn't you?
Yes, I did, and I probably should have hung up because I told them, Misty, you just talked to, the program was going to be at 7, but she called in. So I was going to repeat what she said, but I'll just make testimony to the LEAP program. I am a volunteer now, and I'm encouraging people with programs within their community to volunteer. It's an outreach. You really learn a lot, and you're really support to the family. And I am a volunteer, and it really is a nice experience. So this is what I encourage people to do, and thank you for this show.
Well, thank you, Jackie. And I know that you specifically also wanted to know, and we touched on it, you were interested in pre- or early-onset Alzheimer's or dementia, and you even said pre-Alzheimer's or pre-dementia. Is there a difference, Dr. Carlson?
Well, we don't know for sure how and what person's risk is to develop dementia. Again, there are certain early-onset Alzheimer's forms that are very linked to genes, but otherwise we don't know for sure if someone's going to get Alzheimer's disease down the road. But what we do use are some different brain scan markers, some blood tests, some spinal fluid tests to try to better identify who's going to be at risk for the disease, and then to do studies in those people so we can try to find good prevention therapies. So, again, right now we don't have a clear idea of who's at risk because we don't want to wait till someone gets memory problems. We want to find out before they get memory problems if they're at risk. So, again, pre-dementia or preclinical Alzheimer's disease basically means they have brain changes that haven't shown up as memory problems yet, but we use these biomarker measures, these blood tests, MRI scans, in a research setting to better understand what that person's risk is.
Let's take another call from Therese in Green Bay. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. This was a great show. Thank you for having it. I'm in one of the studies in Madison, and I've heard through some of Dr. Carlson's colleagues that one of the issues with funding deals also with just all the advocacy that's done for cancer, heart, and some of the other diseases, and that we could use more advocacy for research funds, which would help the Alzheimer's disease cause. And I wonder, Dr. Carlson, if you could comment on that.
I fully agree with that. I think there are a variety of different types of advocacy groups that have gone to Washington and others to advocate for more funding for Alzheimer's disease. I think one positive outcome from that is that we do have last 3 years or so, the government for the first time ever has developed a national plan for Alzheimer's disease to help us better understand where we are as a country with developing resources for patients and what types of research resources we need as well. So I think there's progress being made. You know, again, the Alzheimer's Association, the Alzheimer's Intervention Alliance, local groups throughout the state are really pushing for people to increase funding for Alzheimer's disease. And that does really help. So I encourage people to talk to their representatives or senators to try to work towards increasing funding in this area.
Yeah, because as we started the program, this is such a widespread condition affecting so many people, And more people, as the population ages, not to mention their families and the impact on the healthcare system. I mean, what would happen if we didn't find treatments or cures for Alzheimer's disease?
Well, as I mentioned, the number of people with Alzheimer's is expected to triple over the next 40 years or so. And so really we're at this critical junction where we need to find good prevention therapies. And if it doesn't prevent the disease completely, at least if we delayed it, 5-10 years, that's 5 or 10 more years that a person would have with healthy memory, being able to interact with their families and friends, being able to be productive in the workplace. So again, I think the efforts for prevention are critical. So the funding, volunteering to be a part of studies, even just getting the word out that Alzheimer's disease is a disease, that there are resources to help people, to educate people about what the disease is and what it isn't, is really important. But again, it's going to take a team effort, a family effort, friends getting together and saying we're going to work together to help end this disease.
Yeah. In the meantime, your last words of advice for all of us who might want to do whatever we can to prevent this from happening to us, or to at least delay it happening to us.
Well, I did have one research participant who told me, I can't go to medical school, but I can be a part of these studies. And I think, again, being a part of studies, being a part of community events, volunteering, helping someone with maybe some respite stay who's taking care of someone with Alzheimer's. I think, being aware of Alzheimer's disease, recognizing that it's a disease that is hard on families and friends as well as the individual. So thinking about how you can be an advocate either through education, through research, through support of a friend or family is critical. Again, our upcoming November lecture is another way to be in touch with us and see what other opportunities there are to volunteer in our community. So we encourage people to attend. We'll be there to answer questions on November 21st.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Cindy Carlson is an associate professor of geriatrics in the Department of Medicine at UW-Madison. And the event that she is talking about is on November 21st. Aging Strong, Reducing Your Risk for Alzheimer's at the Monona Terrace in Madison. Thanks to Robin Cherry and to Christy Taylor for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.